So you are here to hear what journalism may learn from science.
Science.
I'm Gideon Litchfield. I write for The Economist. I used to write about science. I used to study science, physics, and philosophy. Now I do other things, but I'm still very much a scientist at heart.
And Gideon basically is all the legitimacy in this presentation. I am Matt Thompson. I have never studied science. I am not a scientist. I am a journalist. And I don't fully understand science, so hopefully Gideon can help keep me in line. The hashtag for this presentation is #JournoSci. Don't do any of the truncating with the SX JournoSci, just JournoSci. Let's keep it simple. And before we begin properly, we have a few disclaimers to mention. First of all, journalism, of course, is not science. The two disciplines have widely different aims. They have widely different metabolisms. They function in society, of course, in different ways. So we are not making any claim that we want to turn journalism into science.
However, that said, we also want to make clear that this presentation itself is not science. We are not going to be very precise. We are going to be, in fact, incredibly blunt. We're going to be vague. We're going to throw concepts out there. We're going to be highly unscientific about it. What we're going to talk about in this presentation is not how journalism might be science. We're going to talk about how journalism might borrow from science, because basically our premise is this. Science and journalism are both about describing and explaining the world. They both make observations about the world and try to understand from that how the world will be in future. Science has, as Matt says, a whole methodology about doing this. Journalism doesn't really. So we're going to look at what it is that journalism could borrow from science to make it just a little bit better at keeping track of what is going on.
So we'll start with the first question. Why? Why would we want to turn journalism into something that looks more like science as opposed to the reverse?
Right. So this is a scientific paper. Okay, as you can see, it has a lot of long words in it, and what these long words tell you is that the writers of this paper are really being extremely careful. They're defining their terms, they're being quite cautious about what they predict and what they observe. I'm also going to ask you to notice the word not in the title. That not is actually quite crucial, because one of the features of science is that it makes theories, it tends to falsify ability. In other words, it makes predictions and then tries to find out whether or not those predictions can be falsified, can be proved wrong, because only by doing that can you figure out whether or not your suppositions are accurate or not. Journalism, however, works in rather a different way. So if this is how a scientist sees the world, this is how journalism sees the world. And this is in particular how journalists see the world when science is involved. They make very broad, sweeping statements about it. They say what the future is going to be like. There's no falsifiability about it. Journalism, unlike science, tends to start from the assumption that something is true and then try to find confirmation that it's true. Science starts from the assumption that something might be true and then tries to find out the conditions under which it's not true, because that is how you define your knowledge.
And there are a lot of suppositions here, if you notice. This is these headlines, and headlines in journalism often are guesses, hypotheses. Could this new melanoma treatment be a turning point against cancer? Is there a pill that could prevent racism? The scientists, you may be familiar with the science news cycle from Jorge Cham at phdcomics.com. So you begin with your research, which says that under conditions C and D, A, it may be correlated with B. The university PR office picks that up and says, for immediate release, science find potential link between A and B under certain conditions. By the time it gets to the news wire, it's A causes B, say scientists. And then we move through the internets where it finally makes it to cable news. A causes B all the time. What will this mean for Obama? That is probably as fair as anything else a representation of how it works. But then we've got science. The scientific method, which, when really codified just a few hundred years ago, this set of tools and conventions became responsible for all these fantastic discoveries, for lifting humankind into its current state and, in fact, into the atmosphere. Science has built this huge body of knowledge that has advanced us well beyond where we were when we started cobbling together these tools, these conventions, these methodologies. And how is it that science has been so clearly and demonstrably effective when journalism, one might argue, is still very much arguing for its own relevance?
And so the reason for this difference between the two of them, we think, is the quest for truth. Journalism and science both notionally are about a quest for truth, but science goes about it in a very clear way. It defines what truth would be. It has an epistemology. It has a set of rules for knowing when you know something, for defining when you know something and when you do not know something. Journalism, the main rule that journalism has, the main thing that journalism can claim to call an epistemology, is probably the rule that says that we know something when two separate people have told us that it's true. That's about all there is. Science has a much clearer and more rigorous way of defining when we know that something is true. And that probably is what is reflected in the public prestige of scientists versus journalists. According to this poll, as you can see, people believe scientists, people don't really believe journalists. And we would claim that is at least partly to do with the way that scientists and journalists separately go about seeking their truth. So the problem is, how are we going to make journalism more like science? How are we going to make our quest for truth a bit more like the scientific one?
So we're talking about tools and conventions here, and let me posit a three-part test for whether a tool or convention or methodology could be adoptable within journalism. First, it must be self-justifying. That is, it must be useful all on its own, even if nobody else takes it up. The tool or convention or methodology that we're posing has to be useful to the journalist or news organization that's going to implement it. Second, it has to be...
An example of this is Storify.
So you take a tool like Storify, which has now been widely adopted around the news ecosystem, and part of the reason for that is because it filled a need for reporters. It doesn't just sort of pull social media sources together in an intriguing way. It also makes it really easy for a reporter to pull together a story on the fly from a variety of social sources from all over the place.
The second requirement for any tool that journalists would use to make their method a bit more scientific is that these tools have to be interoperable. They have to be able to work in a variety of different environments. What do we mean by that? Well, here's another example, once again using Storify. Storify can be embedded on any page. It is basically a transportable widget that allows you to collect materials from around the web and then insert them into your story, no matter where your story is published. That is one of the things that makes Storify so powerful and so ubiquitous, interoperability.
And the third is that it has to be easy to use. We can't pose very complicated conventions. Journalists, even journalists who are resistant perhaps to change, need to be able to just quickly and intuitively pick up whatever methodology or tool or convention it is we're proposing. So Storify, again, this gorgeous drag-and-drop interface made it very easy for even a reporter who would have some trouble looking at an Excel spreadsheet would actually be able to work with a Storify story.
So then the question is, well, what is it that we are trying to achieve here? We've said journalism could be more like science. We've talked about the ways in which the tools that would enable that have to be. You've said that they have to be interoperable, easy to use, and whatever the other thing was. But what is it that we're trying to achieve with science? Well, science has a lot of qualities to it that give it this quest for truth. And we've isolated three things that we think kind of sum up what science really is about that we think journalism could borrow from. The first is that science is collaborative. Scientists are building an edifice of knowledge. Every scientist sees themselves as part of this grand quest for knowledge, and they don't feel bad about the fact that they might be working in some tiny corner of it because they know that they are contributing to the greater sum of human happiness and knowledge. And so when you look at a scientific paper, it is full of these things. These are references. These are things that point to other scientific papers and say, I can do this work now because these people have done this work before me, and I am building on their work. And that set of references creates both an established base of knowledge. It tells everyone how we know what we already know, and it tells us where we got that knowledge from so that others can go back and see where it came from. And this is summarized in what's called the Science Citation Index. And the Science Citation Index is a way for you to navigate through the sum total of human knowledge which is contained in scientific work. And it also provides another important function, which is it's a measure of reputation. If you are a scientist who is cited a lot in the Science Citation Index, if your works appear there a lot, it shows that you do good work because other people refer to you. So scientists using this build on one another's work.
So do journalists, of course, right? There's no lone reporter out in the wilderness just covering a subject alone. Very often there's a body of reporters from a variety of news organizations covering the same issue or story. And they also relate to each other. They build on one another's work, sort of. Right? So a particular news story, like a story from Politico, might very well cite, say, a report from the Center for Public Integrity. Journalists, of course, recognize and link to each other's work. They understand that they're in similar domains and what have you. We also have the beginnings of a recognition that there are clusters of reporters working on different subjects. We've got these Google News, when you see the view of a story in Google News, it shows you that there are 375 news stories covering the homeless hotspots at South by Southwest. You go to a site like TechMeme or MediaGazer, and it will show you, sort of, to the best of its ability, the body of journalists who are covering a particular issue. So we've got the beginnings of something that reflect the fact that there is a group of journalists working on a common problem, trying to find, advance the state of knowledge on a story or an issue. But we don't have a citation index for news. We don't have any sort of proper indication or structured indication of who are the reporters working on a given topic and what have they brought to the table. What this might do, a citation index, first of all, it would help foster better knowledge sharing, of course. If we had some sort of mechanism for figuring out, all right, these are the other, just as a beat reporter covering a beat, here's some of the other work that I've read, here are some of the other stories that I've referenced in compiling this one, that would help us trade notes with each other, just within the industry. It would also help us expose multiple perspectives to the public. Knowing consistently that there's a body of different takes on a particular issue or story is a valuable thing. It acknowledges the multiplicity of perspectives that journalism ostensibly celebrates at its best. And lastly, as Gideon mentioned, it would help establish reputation too. We look at the number of sites, the number of citations. That, incidentally, was one of the initial inspirations for Google's PageRank algorithm, right? Looking at how scientists cited each other in scientific literature noting that those sites as a measure of reputation.
So we don't know yet what a citation index for journalism would look like, but as we said, there is the beginnings of it already there, and it would be interesting to discuss how would you take it further, how do you turn it into something more robust. So the next quality of science that we think we want to bring to journalism is its replicability. And what do we mean by replicability? We actually mean something like transparency, but a bit more specific than that. So scientists show their work. You read a scientific paper, it's got the references, it's got the methodology, it has the experimental results, it shows you how it reached its conclusions. All of this is fine and good, and it makes the stuff transparent. But the reason for that transparency, the reason that is important, is that other scientists can then take that work and repeat it. They can repeat the experiment to check that you did it right. They can repeat the experiment under slightly different conditions to see whether your hypothesis holds more broadly. And it is by extending the reach of hypotheses that they turn into broader understandings of the world. So replicability is a key part of what makes science work. And for journalism, we think that there ought to be a similar criterion. When you look at a story, when you look at a journalistic article, can you recreate the work that the journalist did just by reading that article? Now, most of the time you can, to an extent, but really, it's rather crude. I mean, you read an article in a newspaper. It says it quotes somebody. It gives some facts from somewhere. But you would be hard pressed in a lot of cases to recreate the trail of investigation that the journalist did, because we tend to protect our work. We tend not to show too much of how we did it. We don't want other people to scoop us.
So replicability means, again, we talk about transparency quite a bit, but replicability means that you're actually giving the public, giving, say, the reader of a news story, some information about how information was acquired. I would posit that there is a material journalistic difference between these things, between blank assertion, said the official, blank assertion, the official told me, blank assertion, the official told me over drinks after work, or said the official in a call with multiple reporters. These are actually, there are differences between these things. They expose methods. They expose methodologies.
They also give you some indication of how much you should trust what the official said. Gives you a little bit of insight into how the information was transmitted.
So by hewing to the standard of replicability, we're actually creating a stronger notion of transparency. There are some key journalistic outlets and there are examples in the wild of folks really taking a creative tack towards this idea of replicability. So PolitiFact, rather, every time they rate a factual claim by a politician or a pundit, they include the list of sources that they cited in reviewing that claim. They say, here's who we spoke to, this came from an interview, etc. And you can see that just alongside all of their judgments. So ostensibly, you could go back to these sources and check their work yourself. ProPublica. When ProPublica did a massive investigation on nurses who had previously done bad work, essentially, who are still in the registered nursing system and still working at hospitals, they actually created what they called a reporting recipe to allow others to follow up on that work and to do it, to recreate it. They said, this is who we spoke to, these are the types of questions that we asked them, and here's how to get information from possibly publicly available sources about this story. It's a way of actually enabling for ProPublica. The reason that this was a self-justifying thing was that it spread the impact of this giant investigation. It wasn't just them. It said other news organizations can go out and do it as well. But it also had the byproduct of allowing you to investigate ProPublica's methodology and see whether or not it worked. Lastly, the New York Times is one of many news organizations using a tool called Document Cloud. This means that every so often when you're reading a New York Times story, and a story on several other websites that use this tool, you might see a little icon next to a link. When you hover over that link, you'll see a link to the source document itself, this thing that we're referring to, which you can then go and read. You can, alongside the reporter's notes on that document. All of that, we talk about this as transparency, but this enables you to take that same source material and perhaps try to see what the reporters, where the reporters take might differ from your own. We have this standard, so NPR just released this new ethics handbook.
Which Matt was the co-author of.
Which I helped author. And one of the guidelines that we give to our reporters in accuracy is that a reporter should be able to identify the source of every fact that he or she reports, right? We say when making a general assertion of fact in a story, the reporter and editor should be able to immediately identify the source. So we've already set this standard that internally we want every time we make a claim in a news story that the reporter should be able to point to where that claim came from.
Now there is already, in fact, a method, a source, you could call it a journalistic source, which does this rather well, and that is Wikipedia. Wikipedia has a rule, or various rules, about the way that information is attributed. And the clearest rule is that if it has to be attributed to a source, to a document that is published, that is on the web. It has, in other words, footnoting. And when you look at a Wikipedia story, of course, as you know, you can go down and you can look at the footnotes, and it doesn't only tell you where it came from, it's not merely a link. It's more than simply a link in a story. We have inline links in news stories. But footnotes go a little further. They tell you something about where the information came from next to the story itself. You don't have to click through in order to understand where it came from. And that's important because each of these footnotes gives you a sense of the credibility of the source from which that information came. And that helps you both with the reading and also with the replicability. So could we have footnotes for news, would that look ridiculous? I mean, Let's imagine, here we have a news story. I mean, it's got one link in it, but it's a long block of text. What if you were to add? What would if you were to add footnotes to it? How would that help your reading, and how would it help your ability to see what's been going on? Footnotes, I think, would help other people understand the work that we do. And so it would make our process more transparent. Footnotes would enable fact-checking to be done more easily, and that applies both to the journalists who wrote the story, to other journalists who are looking at the story, or to readers who are looking at the story. It enables you to follow up what's been done, and maybe call out mistakes. If the reporter has attributed something to someone, and someone else goes and looks at that link and then finds out that actually that's not what they said, footnoting helps that accountability work better. And finally, footnotes add context to the story. If you read a story and you want to know more, it's easy looking through the footnotes to get a sense of what else is out there, skim through it, get even a sense of the backstory, and then, if necessary, follow those links.
So another of the three characteristics of science that we've described is that it's predictive. Gideon said something interesting earlier, which is that journalism lacks an epistemology, that science has an epistemology. And part of what that means is that there are standards within science, multiple standards, for determining a consensus on what information is valid, what information is true, how strong, in essence, a given fact or piece of information is. And one of those tests, one of the key tests there, is this predictive test. It says that if you're a scientist, you create a guess, in essence. You start off with a supposition. This might happen. If we do this experiment, this will be the outcome. If that doesn't work, you discard that hypothesis and you come up with another. And you say, all right, under these conditions, this will be the outcome of this experiment. And then again, you may be wrong. You try that test until you've got something that stands up, that actually accurately predicts the outcome of your experiment. And then you've got a theory. And this is sort of as good as it gets in science. You can only get a theory. You can always say something that is valid. You can always have a valid hypothesis that does accurately predict the outcome of experiments. But you can always have something that's more valid, that's even stronger, more robust, and that holds up for across domains.
And even then, a theory is never absolute certainty. A theory merely says, under these conditions, in these places, we expect that X, Y, and Z will happen. And a theory, as Matt said, therefore is predictive. But it remains falsifiable. You can always go and try to do the experiment that will prove that theory wrong, or at least limit it. And that is one of the aspects that journalism does not have.
So as we've established, this is all about predictions. It's predictive claims. It's saying this is what will happen in the future. And it's a pretty powerful test for establishing was it right or was it wrong. Did it happen or didn't it? How many of you have heard of something called the Friedman Unit? So you know this guy. Everyone's favorite columnist at the New York Times, Tom Friedman, right? So back in November of 2003, Tom Friedman said this about our recent invasion of Iraq. He said, the next 6 months in Iraq, which will determine the prospects for democracy building there, are the most important 6 months in U.S. foreign policy in a long, long time.
That's an incredibly predictive statement.
Right.
The next 6 months, specific time period, which will determine the prospects for democracy building. They will. Not a question about it. They will. Are the most important 6 months in U.S. foreign policy in... Okay, so then he becomes a little more vague. A long time, but fine. That's quite a prediction.
So for the next, fast forward 11 months to October of 2004 in an interview with Fresh Air, when Tom Friedman says, what we're going to find out in the next 6 to 9 months is whether we have liberated a country or uncorked the Civil War.
Fast forward again, improv time is over. This is crunch time. Iraq will be won or lost in the next few months.
You keep on going until December 8th, 2006, when Tom Friedman says, it's going to be decided in the next weeks or months whether there's an Iraq there worth investing in.
This is 3 years after his initial 6 months.
And this comes from a liberal media watchdog called Fair. But they went back and they tracked all of these Tom Friedman statements that said, in essence, we're going to know this testable claim. We will know the outcome of this experiment in 6 months. And that is a Friedman unit.
Hence the definition of the Friedman unit, which will be published in the Litchfield-Johnson Encyclopedia of Journalology, soon to come out on ebooks near you, is the length of time in which a prediction by a journalist is almost certain to be forgotten. And that is one of the problems that we have. We are not good at all at keeping track of predictions that people make.
The news is filled with predictions. A lot of the matters of controversy in news stories are predictive matters, predictive claims. Could student loans be the next big debt bomb for the U.S. economy? Is a war with Iran a matter of merely saber-rattling, or is it a reality? Will aging nuclear reactors be a giant threat to human existence in the years to come? All of these stories deal with predictive claims, and ostensibly there are multiple sources saying, yes, I think that this will be one of our biggest problems to face, or no, I don't think that it will, or this bill will accomplish X, I actually think this bill will accomplish Y. So we make all these predictions, we include all these predictions, but right now, that's where we leave it. We just say, we'll go to a bunch of sources, we'll gather what they say will happen in the future, and then we'll find some evidence that might, you know, support or undermine each, but otherwise, you know, let's just see.
So a prediction tracker is something that would allow us to hold people to account and to do the work of journalism more effectively, because really what it is about is telling our audience how the world works. And a key part of telling our audience how the world works is seeing whether how people said it would work is how it actually works. And we're not really good at doing that. And that, I think, is one of, when you look at the debates that go around the big issues of the day, around healthcare, around the deficit, around everything else, people are very confused about them, and part of that is because no one is really keeping track of who said what would happen when.
Except for a few key examples in the media, like PolitiFact, again, which has this wonderful thing called the Obamator. So back in 2008, they gathered all of the promises that Obama, then-candidate Obama, had made in the run-up to the 2008 election, saying, if you elect me, I will do X. Again, a predictive claim. A hypothesis. If you elect me, in the next 4 years, I will accomplish X. And so PolitiFact made this tool that said, first of all, here are the 500-something claims that President Obama has made. Will he fulfill these claims? Very testable condition. They went back and they rated each one of these claims. So now if you go to PolitiFact, you can see, was the promise broken? Was it stalled somehow in Congress? Was there a compromise that didn't quite get all the way to what he claimed or didn't? Or was the promise kept? Or is it in the works? The Obamator and the promise tracker, as PolitiFact calls it, is just one example of the type of predictive tracker that could be really powerful, both for the public and for journalists. It causes us, it enables us, reporters and journalists, to press our sources for something stronger, something more robust than a vague prediction like, if we pass this bill, families will go hungry. All of a sudden, what we need, what we want, because we want to be able to pull it into our prediction tracker, is a testable hypothesis. If we pass this bill, X number of families will meet Y testable conditions within Z timeframe. A stronger, more robust assertion. What exactly are you saying will happen if we take this action? So it will help elicit more specific predictions, as I mentioned, giving us a test of, is this a claim that we can actually work with or not? It gives the public a framework for anticipating an issue. So right now, or back in 2008, the Obamator was a pretty terrific way of evaluating how well President Obama was performing. It wasn't the only test. It wasn't the only way to evaluate the president's performance and his conduct in office. But it was one pretty valuable one. This is what the president said he would do. Has he done it? For other issues, this could be a really valuable framework as well and a way to approach the issue. If the Affordable Care Act passes, X, Y, and Z will occur. All right, the Affordable Care Act has passed. What's happening? What did we say was going to happen, and how well are those things conforming to reality? Lastly, it would help us hold public figures accountable. So we have all of these sources, pundits like Tom Friedman, politicians who are making testable claims. This would be a stronger standard for saying, all right, we are going to keep track of these things. We're going to come back to this story. We're going to follow it up, and we're going to see, were you right? Which is something that right now we don't often do. So we've given you just a few ideas, and we wanted to leave actually a fairly wide amount of time for conversation. So Right. Let's just summarize.
So let's wrap this up. We've talked about how we want journalism to be able to borrow some aspects from the scientific method. And we've said, by the way, that whatever tools have to be constructed in order for journalism to act in a more scientific way, they have to be tools that are easy for journalists to use and that will work well with other tools. And the third thing that I always forget. Good.
Self-justifying.
That's right. They have to be self-justifying. They have to be useful for the journalist in and of themselves, even if nobody else is using them. And then we've said that there are three basic features of science that we think journalism should have in some form.
They're like the lowest hanging fruit in some ways.
And they are, number one, it should be collaborative. In other words, the ability that scientists have to build on one another's work to expand the body of knowledge ever wider is something that journalists should become better at. And we've suggested that one of the important tools for achieving that would be something akin to the Science Citation Index, which allows people to refer to each other's work as a way to build on it, and also to enhance people's reputation. The second broad quality of science that journalism should have is replicability. And as we said, this is transparency plus. Replicability means doing the story in such a way that other people can see how you did it and could repeat it themselves so that they can then take that research further. And that, therefore, enables the collaborative aspect. And finally, we need a better form of predictability or predictiveness for journalism, because science is about saying, this will happen, here is precisely what will happen if conditions A, B, and C apply. Journalism also tries to tell us to keep track of what will happen under certain conditions, but it's in fact very bad of keeping track. And so we've suggested that for replicability, we suggested there was footnoting. For predictiveness, we suggested that we need something like a prediction tracker that keeps track of what people have said will happen, holds public figures accountable, and makes it easier for the public to have a broader sense of what is going on. Now, the thing is, these are not the only qualities that science has. Of course, science is a very big thing. It's a very complicated thing. It has other aspects besides these ones that we've talked about. It has falsifiability, which I mentioned, and that's something that's going to be very difficult, I think, for journalists to adopt, because we are used to this way of working where we see a trend and we write a story about how that trend is taking over. We look for things and then we try to confirm them. Science looks for things and tries to falsify them. That's quite a big switch.
The UNC professor Phil Meyer has talked about precision journalism. For a long time, he's talked about one way in which journalism can accrue more of the characteristics of science is by being more precise, by actually using data. And this is something that we're starting to see a lot more of within journalism. My colleague Matt Stiles over there does fantastic data projects with the State Impact Team at NPR. And we're seeing lots and lots of journalists get more excited about the potential for using data to create work that's more robustly informed.
One of the features the other features of science that is an outcome of its being collaborative and replicable and predictive is that it is iterative. You have something that is known and you build on it. Someone else takes it further. We have too much of a tendency in journalism to not throw away, but fail to rely on work that is done before. There is not enough that we can point to and say, okay, this is known. We don't need to dig that up again. Part of that is because of the politicization of journalism. But nonetheless, I think that there is scope for more solid knowledge and therefore more iteration on that knowledge.
There's a focus within science on process that we lack within journalism. The notion that just how you accomplish something, both having a consistent process and a process that is consistent across the discipline, is incredibly important. Using tools like double-blind controlled studies to be able to ensure that you eliminate from your process things like confirmation bias. So these are just some of the characteristics and some of the strongest characteristics that make science what it is, that make the scientific method what it is. But then there are so many other possibilities. And this is what we kind of want to leave you with and throw it open to. What does peer review look like in a journalistic context? What does that convention, which has added quite a bit to journalism, look like? Again, we have steps towards it. We've got editing. But what can we learn from how science has accomplished this?
We have editing. We have commenting on stories. We have comment threads. We have things like News Trust, which look at and which are an attempt to rate stories. These are all versions of peer review. But what would it look like in a more solid context?
And then what might blind tests look like in a journalistic context? Again, this tool invented to help mitigate some of the confirmation bias that scientists claim. So we talked about what, we've talked about why, we've talked about how. So who does this? Who actually is responsible for accomplishing these claims? In part, everyone who's interested in these things, everyone who believes that journalistics should take on a more scientific bent, can help bring us somewhere closer to this. But the key thing is that we've got to have folks with this thinking in news organizations. And so if we could just plug a little PSA, come work for us. If you've got skills like programmers, engineers, talk to us. Give us your names. Infect our organizations with some of these qualities. And now bring us your thoughts and questions. Got a mic up here, and just queue up and let's start going.
Thank you.
Hi. You mentioned the idea of doing a prediction tracker for journalists and that it would drive journalists to make better predictions. How do you know it wouldn't just drive journalists to stop making predictions? That I know it's hard to predict the future, and if my entire story is disqualified because my one prediction is wrong, couldn't that story still have merit even if that part was off?
Well, I think we're not really talking about whether journalists make predictions so much. It's about how well journalists track the predictions that other people make.
Right.
Whether that is public figures, scientists, whoever.
Yeah, I would say it's sort of a two-part test, because I think both versions of that question are legitimate. We also do news stories that are themselves predictive, right? We say we do news stories aging nuclear reactors. Is this the new dangerous threat? And we have stories that are intended to say, James Fallows, a journalist for the Atlantic Monthly, did this story in the November 2002, I believe, issue of the Atlantic, asking the question, what will happen the day we invade Iraq? What happens? So, you know, it feels like it may be a foregone conclusion that we're going to invade Iraq sometime next year. What happens then? And it was a story that was strongly predictive. He went through, and in fact, if you go back and you look at that story, which won a National Magazine Award, he went back and he sort of walked through his methodology, he walked through his starting assumptions, and he talked about, after talking with all of these different types of officials who might have knowledge on the subject, how they changed. You can now go back and review that 2002 story and see that 5 months before we invaded Iraq, Fallows and several other journalists had begun to anticipate the problems that we'd face over the next decade. So there's, I think, both the strength of forcing journalists to be more rigorous about how they consider potential outcomes, and also forcing them to press their subjects to make more testable claims.
And I'll just weigh in also that if journalists made fewer predictions, it might not necessarily be such a bad thing.
Right.
Because we have this tendency when we write stories to round them off with some sweeping prediction because it kind of reads well and, you know, gets people talking. But maybe we should be more careful.
Exactly.
Okay. So I'd like to talk a little bit about facts. You started this out as, journalism, the pursuit of truth. And we didn't talk a lot about the nature of facts, and I think that's where we're trying to get to. Michael Mann, who was on Sci-Fry a couple weeks ago, talked about this, and one of the things he said, which I've said a lot of times, is there aren't necessarily two sides of a story, and I see that a lot in journalism. It's like, you know, you get the two talking heads up, and you know, this guy's argument and this guy's argument. When one of them may be factually wrong, But I don't see that analysis in journalism, what I feel often enough, and I think this mechanism could work, but you didn't talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about that idea? Because I often see them and I say, this guy's wrong. You know, and Michael Mann had that, and he was, I don't know if you listened to that.
Right, yes.
He was more than vehement, probably.
So Michael Mann is the infamous hockey puck scientist.
Right.
The scientist who gave us the hockey puck graph for climate change that Al Gore made famous in An Inconvenient Truth. Climate change is probably the example that many critics of journalism bring up, especially scientists, as an example of where journalism often falls short. There are many complicated issues of climate change. It probably took many journalists a good number of years to figure out that the problems over anthropogenic climate change and to the extent to which climate change was caused by human was a subset of the question over whether climate change is happening at all, and that there, and even sorting out those claims. Like, it's easy to throw a lot of fog when you're main domain is not science. But in fact, I think we didn't really dwell on, beyond talking about sort of prediction and hypothesis and theory as some of the ways that science has a strong epistemology, science has a strong way of establishing what is valid, what's a stronger claim, what is more truthful, what's more factual. We didn't do a full-on epistemology for journalists, like philosophy section, because we could go deep.
We did mention PolitiFact.
We did, right.
Which does do this attempt to go back behind statements and say, well, what actually is true? I think that part of what addresses the problem of fact is things like PolitiFact, is things like citations, because if you refer back to research that has been done or to work that has been done by other journalists, you can talk more about what is established, what is known. And then another thing I think is style. I mean, this is a particular beef of mine coming from Britain, where the press is very opinionated, is more opinionated. And comparing it with America, where is this almost paranoid fear shying away from making a news judgment. And I have a long spiel that I'll give some other day about why that is, why the journalistic cultures in the two countries are different. But it is something of the attitude here, yeah. and I think that may just be changing, though.
But in fact, you would see, if you read the NPR Ethics Handbook, for example, in the fairness section, we say that above all, our most important, we are reporting primarily for the public, of course, and in the public interest. So the most important consideration in a story is to be fair to the truth. Make sure if the balance of evidence in a controversy weighs more heavily on one side, that we reflect that, we represent that in our story to our readers.
And you've got a lot of stick for that.
Users.
First, I'd like to say I loved your presentation style. You two should keep those lab coats on and do this for a living.
Thank you.
But I also got a question. You presented some very interesting ideas for standards. I wonder, is anybody doing this? And if so, shouldn't the science journalists, the ones who report about science, shouldn't they be especially close to these standards since they work with scientists, are close to their values and standards? Have you found out whether they actually are closer to your standards?
I'll say two things. In response to that, first is that we wanted to make sure that we were actually showing examples of where news organizations are doing this already, so that we could build on those examples. I mean, we've shouted out PolitiFact an awful lot. And PolitiFact, of course, is not without its controversies, especially right now. But they are doing a lot of things that are sort of pushing forward the way we think about what's possible in telling news stories.
Yeah, but that's not science journalism.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the second question about science journalists and the particular sort of closeness that they feel to these processes, I think is a really interesting one. I work closely with a scientist turned journalist in Cape Cod who reports on the oceans and climate change and their effect on Cape Cod. And there actually are quite a few tensions between scientists and journalists often. I think there are tensions between journalists who report primarily on science and journalists who see their scientific, their stories about science stories get picked up in HuffPo. There's a lot of light between these different camps in how they go about their work. I think scientists would prefer that that journalists sort of treat their work as incrementally as they do. You know, you might spend your entire career focused on the laser sharp question within your discipline. And journalists are, of course, more general. We're talking about broader phenomena. We're trying to get to what's happening now, what's happening now. And I think that's always going to be a tension. But I do think that journalists who report on science and understand the ways it works can do a lot to help influence the rest of the field in being more rigorous more epistemological, in fact, in how we do our work.
I mean, as someone who spent 2 years as a science journalist, the way that the kind of thing that science journalists do is not really that different from the thing that other journalists do in terms of the product, right? What they produce, articles. And what we have talked about is a lot of the things that go underneath or around or behind articles, other furniture that allows the readers or other journalists to see how the thing was done. In that sense, as I said, science articles and other articles are no different from each other at present. Science journalists may be a little bit more careful in the way that they write, but they too are subject to the same pressures to make a story exciting and sensational and so forth. So I think that the techniques that we're talking about aren't necessarily something that the science journalists should be pushing. It's something that innovators in the journalism sphere should be pushing everywhere. And I also don't think it's so much about standards as it is about people just trying things. Things like Politifact, things like Document Cloud, things like News Trust, some of them work, some of them don't. It's very hard to know what will actually meet those conditions of, you know, interoperability and ease of use and so forth. So people have to try things and see what catches on.
I really appreciated the presentation. A lot of good, challenging ideas. A couple things. First off, it also seems that a big difference is that science is also working within really, really specified preconditions that have no room for randomness.
Absolutely.
Or variability. Also, having a sort of peer review and revealing all your sources and use is often a liability because you end up damaging fragile relationships and people and insiders that don't want to be revealed, and then you actually get less information if you do that.
Right.
But something that interests me is, in reading a history of journalism, it seems that somewhere around the 60s, like the National Journal Association or some crap tried to come up with a code of ethics so that everyone could kind of agree upon a certain amount of methods. And a lot of journalists actually reacted vehemently against it because they were kind of like, look, don't tell us what to do. We each have our own methods. Like, you know, you can't sort of codify this entire thing. And I'm wondering, like, if you think that either we would have that sort of same reaction now, because it seems like a code of ethics differs even from a style book. It's not just about what you capitalize or, you know, you go about collecting information, but, you know, how you do certain things. It's important to me because I think that we need to codify a way to teach underrepresented voices in media how to create their own media instead of having a top-down approach. So I'm just curious, what do you think about the reaction to that these days, and can there be a sort of codified ethics amongst the blogosphere?
Yeah. You go.
I was going to say, I think, so things like having footnoted stories, having a standard where on your stories you just say every fact that you cite, every assertion, every claim that you include in the story, here's where we got it, here's how. That would create a pressure on other journalists working within your tier and your peer set to match that standard to a certain extent. I mean, that also creates a certain amount of literacy about how we get information and what a strongly sourced story looks like versus a really poorly sourced story. If you started seeing the sources, how a good journalist goes about prosecuting his information, if you started seeing that information somewhere, all of a sudden that sort of sets apart the incredibly well-reported New York Times story from something in another outlet that might be a one-source kind of lark.
Right, because this is a problem that news organizations have, the biggest problem right now, right? It's trust, it's authority. It's the thing that is, as they all struggle to survive, it's one of the things that can maybe give them an edge over their rivals. So I think that, as Matt says, if you make that process more transparent and that creates the sense of authority and reliability, then at least for some of your users, hopefully a large enough part of them, that's going to be what's important. And again, it's not really about imposing a code of ethics. I don't think anybody would sensibly do that. It's about saying this is in your interest because it will help your authority.
Yeah. We'll try to just one of us answer each of the next questions so we can move it along quite quicker so we can get to the queue.
Hi. Thank you both for your talk. I have a question in that scientists get the luxury of funding that comes from an intermediary body such as the NSF or other government bodies that allocate money and thus have the freedom to not worry so much about public perception and the day-to-day funding, a luxury that obviously newspapers right now are not enjoying. And I wonder if you feel that there's anything that journalism can borrow from science in terms of financial support, because I do feel like a lot of the shortcuts and a lot of the sensationalism and so on come from that need to constantly survive, which science just doesn't have to worry about as much.
I mean, I don't feel, first of all, I wouldn't underestimate the amount of politics that there is in science funding. And, you know, people have to jump through some amazing hoops sometimes to get their grants. I don't know. It's a tricky one. At one level, news organizations are always going to have this mass appeal thing, so that makes them fundamentally different from science, and that's not going to go away. If what you're doing builds, as I said, that longer term sense of trust and authority, and if you can somehow balance that against the short term needs, and there are some organizations like the New York Times, like the Guardian, that are gambling on this. They're saying, if we can hold out, it's that trust in our solidness, in the solidness of our reporting, that is going to make us stick around in the long term. So it's kind of short term versus long term balance, which is what a lot of institutions of all kinds have to grapple with.
Yeah, I guess my question is quite related to that, actually. I mean, the human mind loves a narrative, especially a narrative which affirms one's existing state of mind. A lot of what you've described here seems rather incompatible with that fact, and therefore perhaps the people responsible for these journalists might not be so fond of journalists that go down this path, and even if they did, perhaps they might not then get the eyeballs that would make the whole thing worthwhile. How do you see resolving this possible incompatibility?
I mean, I'm not sure that I see an incompatibility, because I'm not suggesting that the stories that journalists write are necessarily going to change that much. It's more about the way that they use other material to source those stories, to make those stories transparent and so forth. But, you know, the basic piece, the basic information that you're putting out is still going to be more or less, it's still basically going to be the same. And the way that people fit information that they get in the world into narratives is also going to be the same. And that's a much broader question, which is how do... When one bunch of people believe fervently that climate change is a hoax, right? Or people have fervently different beliefs about, let's say, the Middle East conflict. Those narratives are very entrenched, and how you get people to adapt those narratives on the basis of new information, that's a whole other discussion that I wouldn't even... And I'm not sure that what we're talking about would necessarily solve that on its own. I think that it would be part of the, it would be a piece of it, but not the whole thing.
I'll also violate my earlier thing just to say, I think actually narrative would be improved by a lot of this stuff. I mean, if you talk about, if you've ever read a long investigation, that can be some hard stuff to read because of the way that you have to source your claims within the body of the story. It really sort of dulls down the narrative. You have to say, instead of saying, 900 doctors are dying by, according to a report by the 2005 report, in the middle of a sentence, actually pulling that out of a story, pulling it in the footnotes, that's a stronger thing. The prediction tracker, predictions are an amazing story frame. The future, everybody wants to know what's going to happen in the future. If you say this bill, these are three of the possibilities that the major sources on this story are saying will happen if we pass this bill, I think it's actually a really compelling frame with which to write about something. Yeah.
First of all, I thought it was a really great presentation, and my question kind of ties in on theirs, is how would this work from a business perspective within a news organization? Because, they're already not wanting to fund long-form journalism, and just it's cost prohibitive to all the time that it takes to verify, which, of course, I prefer it to be that way, but it's against the way the world is today about, staying on top of what's hot in the news and being at the top, being seen, and then the whole with the bloggers and journalists and all that. So, how would that work? And would it be an outside organization that would do this, and the news organizations would pay for, like a vendor, or would they have a unit within the news organization that would only do this, or would each team for each show or beat or would be responsible for their own and all be trained? And how would this happen?
I would say that, I mean, the different ideas that sort of fall within this Some of them are not really much of a technical or financial hurdle or organizational hurdle at all. It might be difficult, depending on your content management system, for example, it might be difficult to support footnotes within a story. But on the other hand, if you use WordPress, there are actually several easily available plugins that'll let you footnote your claims. I use one of them, WP Footnotes, on my blog. Anybody who wants footnotes on their blog, they should use WP Footnotes because it's pretty awesome. You just put double parentheses around your footnote and instantly it comes all automatic and nice. Anyway, several of the other ideas, I mean, things like citation index, I think that could be implemented both within, I actually think that, you know, the future of something like a tech meme, I would love to see news organizations working with Gabe Rivera and the likes of Gabe Rivera to make that a stronger discipline, to say, all right, let's surface actually everybody who's talking about this stuff. Because, I mean, the value in it for us as news organizations is TechMeme drives a lot of traffic to tech reporters. They want to be on the top of TechMeme. Knowing that if you're writing about something that other journalists are writing about, that your work is reflected there and linked to, I think that's a valuable incentive. So I think for some of the different ideas within the presentation, there are different ways that they might be implemented. And hopefully, and I don't think there's one-size-fits-all solution for any of them, but if just one news organization prominently sort of picked up a standard of going with footnoting stories, I think that would be a really interesting move.
And, you know, tools like Document Cloud are being developed by basically philanthropically supported, grants. And then if they get adopted by news organizations, then everybody benefits.
Now, I had just one more follow-up question. Is even with citations, a lot of reports and even studies, scientific studies, aren't always correct. You know, was the study well done? Was it, you know, so
right.
You're already attributing to something that you don't really have the time to totally verify.
And this is one of those things where it's definitely not going to make it, just having more citations isn't going to make it perfect. It's just going to bring us closer.
So I'm going to talk about people that generally aren't in this room. I mean, this all works great for high-end.
We have a minute and a half left.
Oh, sorry. Okay, never mind. So the short version is, if you look at what people actually read, the most popular website in the world at the moment is the Daily Mail. It is all conjecture about conjecture. If you've ever read TechCrunch, it's conjecture about conjecture about conjecture. How does this work with the vast majority of news that isn't The Economist or the NPR or any other high-end news source?
It's kind of up to those organizations, I guess. I mean, you can't force them. But it may be that even for them, they see a benefit in doing some of this stuff.
Do you actually think they could adopt it without destroying their ease of reading?
I don't think the stories are going to change. They may well do the same stories, but if they provide more information about how they get the stories.
And part of what I would say is that we're talking about things that, sure, if, you know, the Daily Mail doesn't footnote its stories, that actually doesn't have much of an impact on what another news organization does. There are organizations that are doing a lot of really strong reporting that adopting these conventions would start to foster, at least among their audience, a different type of relationship and different expectations that might create larger pressures for the industry that may even influence other actors who might not be willing to be so transparent about their work. But I think that even for the news organization itself, on an individual level, it would be valuable in establishing that trust with their audience.
And if the Daily Mail publishes a piece of crap, excuse my French, and
which it never has done,
which it never has, but let's imagine that some nameless organization publishes something that's rubbish. If someone else is doing a much more solid and footnoted and sourced job, someone can say on Twitter, "Hey, don't read that Daily Mail story; it's full of rubbish. Go and read that." I shouldn't be mentioning the name.
Let's try to get your question in 30 seconds.
Sorry, I'll be quick. I was struck that sports reporters like to kind of test public assumptions, anticipate issues, day trading statistics. They're not perfect, but is there something to learn from their kind of habits and writing style?
What's that?
Sports reporters, is there something to learn from kind of their habits and writing styles?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we can learn from sports reporters. Not narrative styles, not the least.
Well, thank you all very much for coming and for listening.
And thank you for your questions.